This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Tom Hartman is an award-winning and best-selling author and host of the nationally syndicated Tom Hartman radio program, heard here in Central Virginia on the new progressive WVAX 1450 AM, Monday through Friday from noon to 3. Good afternoon, Tom.
Hey, Coy. Great to be here.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us. I know you're one of the busiest people in radio all over America. I know you're finishing a book, and so we do certainly appreciate your time. Tom, let's start with the question right at the top of my list here. Do liberals hate America? We hear it all the time. President Bush says it. We hear it all the time in the media that liberals hate capitalism. They want to see the terrorists win, that they hate America and they hate freedom.
Well, it's frankly a pathetic and tragic accusation. To say somebody who loves their country enough to stand up for it and try to improve it hates it, not only defies decency and morality, it defies common sense.
Tom Hartman, you have written about something called the radical middle. Tell us, what is the radical middle, and what does this view on politics here in America offer us that perhaps the Democrats and the Republicans do not?
Well, if you ask, or actually, it wouldn't even have to be you or me asking. I mean, the surveys have been done. Go back and look at the Zogby or New York Times or CBS polls or whatever. When you ask the American people, do you think that we should have a national health care program, you find over 70% of them say yes. Do you believe that Social Security should be enhanced to the point that people can actually live off it and that it's stable forever? So more than 80% of people will say yes. Do you believe that our federal regulatory agencies should be strong and should be protecting our food supply and our pharmaceuticals and our water and our air? You find over 75% of Americans say yes. Should education be in the hands, largely in the hands of local people and local entities, and should it be well-funded, and instead of things like, you know, the No Child Left Behind mandate that turned a $400 million a year testing industry into a $2.5 billion a year testing industry, which George Bush's brother is profiting from enormously, they will say, no, it should be appropriately funded. If you ask the vast majority of Americans if they think that, Thomas Jefferson's idea of free public education going all the way to the level of PhD is something that's an American value. I mean, that's why he started the University of Virginia. The vast majority of Americans, more than 50%, more than 60% of Americans will say yes. On all these issues, if you were to go on some, national talking head show and say, these are the issues I stand for, they would say immediately, oh, you're the far left. And yet, when you ask most Americans, they say, and so I would say, no, that's not the far left, that's the middle. And the middle is getting angry. the middle, middle America, do you believe that people should be able to if they work, to go back to Teddy Roosevelt's definition of the middle class, if somebody works 40 hours a week and puts in their time, should they be able to have a decent enough paycheck that they can raise kids, own a home, take a vacation and have a pension that they can retire on? The vast majority of people will say yes. Should there be good, strong minimum wage protections? Yes. I mean, right across the board, all of these positions are characterized in our largely very conservative media as being far-left positions, and they're not. They're the positions of the vast majority of Americans. And so that's why I use the phrase radical middle. I say, number one, we're the middle. We really are where the mainstream of America is at. And number two, as we're all watching these things slide away and watching them be under constant assault by conservatives, we're getting radicalized.
My guest is award-winning and best-selling author Tom Hartman, host of the nationally syndicated Tom Hartman radio program, heard here in Charlottesville from noon to 3, Monday through Friday, on the new progressive WVAX 1450 AM. Tom, let's turn our attention to some issues in the news recently. The firing of the U.S. attorneys, the possible involvement by Attorney General Roberto Gonzalez. What do you think, in light of Monica Goodling's recent testimony, what do you think perhaps are the most disturbing or alarming things from your perspective that we should be aware of regarding this story?
Well, there's two that immediately come to mind. The first is that there are a number of civil service positions, the things like immigration judges, federal U.S. attorneys, people who have the ability to make life hell for some people and to give other people a pass. People have the ability to put people in jail or threaten them with protract. I mean, the power of the legal of the federal the legal power of the federal government is extraordinary and vast and can be very frightening. And these positions, although they are appointed by the executive branch, by the president theoretically, these positions have always, in every administration, always in the history of this country, been, because they are civil service positions, I mean, this is why the civil service program was put into place in the first place, been based on merit. We're going to hire the very best people to do these jobs based on civil service test scores, based on curriculum, based on their CV, on their academic history, on their job history in the past, those kinds of things, so that we have really and truly good people running the government, people who very often, in fact, very often from administration to administration, people will stay on in these positions, although, you know, very often they also change as well. But basically these have never been positions that have been handed out as political favors. And it's very clear now, based on Monica Goodling's testimony, that engaged in a fairly methodical and long-standing and ongoing process of converting these positions from traditional civil service positions into political appointments, and that's not good for America, and it's also against the law. So I mean, it's a federal crime, literally. Number one. Secondly, she said in her opening statement, when she was basically trying to cover her backside on all accounts because she'd been given immunity, she needed to confess as many crimes as she could as quickly as she could so she could never be prosecuted for them. She said that Paul McNulty failed to testify before Congress, which is a fancy way of saying basically lied by omission to Congress, that he was familiar with the fact that Karl Rove's assistant, Tim Griffin, who, by the way, was appointed to be a federal attorney down in Arkansas, where Hillary is from, was in the later part of her young life, and throughout, you know, Bill's being governor, that this guy, Tim Griffin, was actually responsible for the caging operations that were done during the George W. Bush 2004 presidential campaign. Caging is a technique that the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, in an investigation they did here in the United States in 2000, after the 2000 election, they concluded that somewhere between 1 million and 4 million Americans who wanted to vote were denied the ability to vote or were given provisional ballots that never got counted as a result of Republican caging operations. The caging is where you mail out a letter to, you identify zip codes, or you can get it down to the point where you identify city blocks that are of a particular demographic. They may be African American, or they may be blue collar, or they may be whatever in a particular area. I mean, it's going to vary from state to state, county to county, city to city, you know, what's most likely going to be Democratic voters versus Republican voters. But they identify those places, or just looking at historic voting patterns for that matter, they identify those city blocks where there are Democratic voters, and then they mail these things to them, and if the mail bounces back undelivered for any one of 100 reasons. I mean, there's it's not just because the person died that mail bounces back, particularly certified mail. If it bounces back, then at the polls, they have these Republican poll challengers. And we all saw all these guys, you know, on TV during the 2000 and 2004 elections. And everybody just figured, oh, they're trying to keep everything honest. Well, what they would do is if you showed up and you had been caged, you were on the caging list, and they would have a list of all the names of all the people who were, you know, who got they had that letter bounced back, and they had the physical letter as their evidence. If you showed up to vote, they'd say, you're not eligible to vote. I deny your right to vote. I'm challenging you. And at that point, you'd have one of two choices. You could just say, okay, screw it. I'm gonna leave and go home. Or you could go home after having, first of all, you don't even find this out until you get up to the front of the line, which in some cases was a five-hour-long line. Then you'd have to go back home and get proof that that actually is your residence. So you'd have to find your your mortgage, copy of your mortgage, or your, you know, two different kinds of utility bills or whatever, and bring it back and find the county clerk registrar of elections and have that person certify that you actually legally can vote, and then go to that Republican lawyer who is, you know, standing there as part of this caging operation challenging voters and say, see, I really can vote, and then get back in line for another 5 hours. And most people wouldn't do that. Now, when the Republican Party first started doing this with Reagan in 1981, it was publicized. Actually, it was being done in the late 70s, but it was like a big deal in the 1980 election. And in 1981, it was first publicized in the national media, which led to a lawsuit against the Republican Party by a and in 1986, a federal court held that the Republican Party was breaking the law, that this was a violation of federal election laws. And that the Republican Party is operating under a federal restraining order ever since 1986, saying that it's illegal for them to do caging. And yet, as I said, the BBC says, as a consequence of caging, they knocked somewhere between 1 and 4 million voters off the rolls in the 2000 election, and it's estimated that at least another million people were caged by 2004 election, the John Kerry election. So there's probably 5 million Americans, 90% of them at least Democrats, who are not allowed to vote. You know, the very tip of that iceberg is that 80,000 African Americans in Florida that were caged that we know about because the NAACP filed a lawsuit against the Republican Party, which is still ongoing, by the way. So when she said that Karl Rove's assistant was in charge of caging for the George W. Bush 2004 election, I mean, I'm just astounded that that wasn't a screaming headline in the New York Times the next day. That was a huge revelation.
My guest is Tom Hartman, nationally syndicated radio host, heard here locally from 12 to 3 p.m. every day on the new progressive WVAX 1450 AM. And the phone lines are open at 977-1070. Tom, this caging of American voters has been very well reported, thanks to Greg Pallas in the U.K., reported well outside of the United States. But we don't hear much about it here in the states, that the Republican Party, and you tell me if the Democratic Party is doing the same thing, I don't know. But we know for a fact the courts have ruled that the Republican Party has been actively involved in voter suppression, in really pulling out all the stops to prevent people from actually casting a ballot in elections. Why is it you think that more Americans aren't aware of this?
That's a really good question, and Coy, and I don't have an answer for it. I'm baffled. The reality is that the Democratic Party has never been accused of caging, to the best of my knowledge, anywhere under any circumstances. The Republicans constantly claim voter fraud, suggesting that there are people among the Democratic constituencies, particularly minorities or people on Native American reservations or whatever, who are illegally voting. And what they're talking about is the kind of thing that, for example, Ann Coulter did, where she registered to vote at the home of, you know, using the address of the home of her realtor rather than her own personal home address. That's actually a federal crime. That's voter fraud. And Ann Coulter was actually going to be prosecuted for that until the FBI intervened and said, no, let her go. Alberto Gonzalez says we don't want to prosecute her. But there was a woman up in Minneapolis who, because this gets us to the whole, you know, why were they purging the federal prosecutors? What Gonzalez was leaning on the federal prosecutor, Karl Rove, was leaning on the federal prosecutors to do over the last 6 years is find instances of, quote, Democratic, as in Big D, Democratic Party voter fraud and prosecute them in a very high-profile way to cause people to think that the Democrats are doing vote fraud, while at the same time the Republicans in the background are doing election fraud, the caging. And there have been a total of 36 cases prosecuted successfully across the United States in the last 6 years. That's it. That's all they could find. And several of these prosecutors, like David Iglesias, for example, has come right out and said, hey, you know, they were leaning on me to do this. I couldn't find any evidence of it. The two or three cases that they were able to find that they, you know, that the Republican Party thought, hey, we've got one here. You know, when we did the investigation, we found out it wasn't the case. I started out by saying there's this one woman in Minneapolis. She'd been in jail in Minnesota. If you are a felon, you're not allowed to vote. She had been convicted of a felony. She got out of jail. She went down and she voted, which was illegal. She went back and met with her probation officer, you know, like a few weeks later. And her probation officer told her that she was not allowed to vote, and she was like, oh, my God. So she herself called the town clerk and said, I voted and I wasn't supposed to vote. Can you remove my vote? And the town clerk said, no, it's too late, and notified the local federal prosecutor. And this woman has been in jail for a year and a month now for illegally voting. Right, and this was trumpeted as one of the triumphs. You know, see, we found proof. There's election fraud. 36 cases nationwide compared to 4 million Americans who've been caged by the... There's no evidence that the Democratic Party has ever in any way, under any circumstances, organized anything like, hey, let's get felons to vote.
We're talking with Tom Hartman, heard here locally on WVAX 1450 AM, Monday through Friday from noon to 3. We invite you to join the conversation at 977-1070. Susan's on line 2. Susan, you're on with Tom Hartman. Go right ahead. Oh, there you go. Hey, Tom, let me ask you, where do you think the firing of this U.S. attorney's thing will go?
It's all going to depend on the press. And you know, this gets back to the question of why hasn't the press reported on you know, caging, for example, in the United States. There's the BBC investigative reports, not just Greg Palast. I mean, he did the big report, but the BBC followed this thing for the better part of a year after the 2000 election. For some reason, and it may go back to Lee Atwater, who was the campaign strategist. He was sort of the Karl Rove to Ronald Reagan, you know, in the Reagan administration.
Right, right.
Lee Atwater's famous saying was, you want to work the refs, terrify the media, make them afraid, make the individual reporters afraid that they will be accused of having bias. And so you got like Bernard Goldberg out there writing his book, Bias, you know, oh, the media is all liberal. And they are so terrified, I mean, for lack of a better word, of being accused of having bias that they don't report on crimes if they're committed by conservatives or Republicans, like caging, for example. That's the only conclusion, that's the only thing that I've been able to come up with is anything that makes any sense at all. I don't think that it's some grand conspiracy between the Republican National, you know, Committee or the Republican Party and General Electric that owns NBC. You know, I don't see it happening that way. I think it's just that reporters have grown timid and scared, and also because Republicans have held so much power over the last couple of decades, well, really since 1980, even though Bill Clinton was president for a while, the Republicans still held most of the power, that you've got a lot of reporters who are providing infotainment rather than news. News has become a for-profit enterprise now rather than, you know, what radio and TV stations do to keep their license and to, you know, the public service for, in exchange for the public airways. And the consequence of that is that you've got these guys, men and women working in the White House press corps, who are pulling down $500,000 a year, $1 million a year, $3 million a year salaries. And the day that the White House says, we're not going to take any more questions from you, George, George loses his job. I mean, that's what happened to Helen Thomas. She asked the wrong question the first day, the first press conference George Bush had. She traditionally was asked, you know, was allowed to ask the first question. She asked the wrong question. She upset George W. Bush. He ordered that she no longer be seated in the front row, and he said he was going to refuse to take questions from her anymore. Within a year, she'd lost her job, and with Associated Press. And, you know, you got people whose careers, you know, they're raising families and they're making good money, and they don't want to give that up. And, you know, as compared to back in the day, you know, back in the Nixon era, Walter Cronkite was on TV every night and, you know, America's Newsman and all that. He was making a salary of $46,000 a year. So I think things have changed substantially. And that's why we don't know about these things.
We're talking with Tom Hartman, host of the Tom Hartman Program, heard here Monday through Friday from noon to 3 on WVAX, the new progressive talk, 1450 AM. Let's continue our discussion with Tom Hartman, award-winning and best-selling author and host of the nationally syndicated Tom Hartman radio program, which is heard here in Charlottesville on the new progressive WVAX 1450 AM, Monday through Friday, from noon until 3. Tom, your take on the supplemental vote in Congress this week. The headlines are full of it. Everybody's trying to make sense. The discussions about it almost sound like commenting on a chess game.
Yeah, and what's so utterly tragic about it, Coy, is that it's a chess game in which human beings are dying, you know, as we speak. The odds are that during the course of this program, you know, a number of human beings have died, and And during the course of this day, several American human beings will have died as well. And you know, we notice and value American lives. I think most of us notice and value all lives. The political calculus on this is that there are people in the Republican Party who realize that regardless of what George Bush may want, he's not running for re-election in 2008. He's kind of beyond lame duck right now. And that if there is a war still going on, I mean, this was the poll by Fox News just 2 days ago, I think it was, maybe 3 days ago, that if people were to vote right now on any race, a presidential race, congressional race, you know, House or Senate, that the number one consideration in their mind would be the war, and or what they refer to as the war. I refer to it as the occupation. In my mind, the war was over when Bush declared mission accomplished, because we really had accomplished the mission of taking out the Iraqi government. I mean, that really and truly was, I don't mean this rhetorically, that really was the end of the war. We took over another country. Then began the occupation, and we've had 4 years of an occupation that's been so badly screwed up that it's led to, you know, basically a revolt by the occupied people. But in any case, the Republicans know that if they go into the 2008 elections with this occupation still going on and our soldiers still at these levels being killed, that it's going to be a bloodbath for the Republican Party. And so they're going to make sure that the war is over, or at least significantly scaled down before November of 2008. They want to do it, however, on their own timeline. They want to do it in a way that will make them look good and make it look like, you know, they're going to be able to claim some benefit, some credit for a victory in those terms. And, you know, it's going to be a variation on the old advice that was given to Richard Nixon, why don't we just declare victory and come home? Or actually, I think it was the senator from Wisconsin, I forget his name, who said that to LBJ, now that I think about it. But in any case, you know, about Vietnam. But the timeline that the Republicans have established to do that, and they've done so quite publicly, by the way, is September, you know, when General Petraeus comes back with his report on how things are going with this surge. And the best guesses of the political pundits that I know and the few elected officials that I know well enough that they'll tell me what they're hearing in the cloakroom and in the dining room and whatnot, you know, not for quoting them by name, but, you know, not minding if I say it on the radio, the best guess is that Petraeus is going to come back in September and say, well, it looks like the surge is really working, and we can start drawing down our forces, and we'll start drawing down our forces, and there will be some parts of the country that will descend into chaos, and other parts of the country that it will very quickly become unchaotic, because local militias will come in and basically take over. I mean, you'll have, be they Sunni areas where you'll see a reinvention of a Taliban-style government, or Shia areas where it'll be sort of a reinvention of an Iranian theocracy. Nonetheless, you know, in either case, it's the end of secular government in Iraq. But you know, it's stable, and so, you know, people aren't being killed, and the Republicans will take credit for that, and then they'll go into the elections in November of 2008 saying, you know, see, we finally brought peace to Iraq, and didn't we do a great job? But they can't do that right now. To do that right now, they would lose face, and the Democrats would get credit for that. And so, you know, there was this game of high-stakes chicken going on, because the administration currently has enough funding to pay for the occupation through the end of August, the Department of Defense budget, but not enough beyond that, in theory. I mean, you know, there's so much money sloshing around in the Department of Defense. They're missing $2 trillion right now that they can't account for, that they probably could have funded the war for another couple of years if they just started finding that $2 trillion. But in any case,
my God.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling when you think about it. And that's that, by the way, is from the Defense Department's auditor, that figure. There's never been an independent audit of the Defense Department.
Gosh. Tom Hartman, host of the nationally syndicated Tom Hartman radio program. If you've got a comment or a question, the phone number is 977-1070. Mike is online, too, in Charlottesville. Mike, you're on with Tom Hartman. Go right ahead.
Hey, Tom. This is Mike Sark. I was actually a guest on your show one time.
Hey,
I'm calling about this Iraq thing because it seems to me that leadership just flipped us all the bird, flipped everyone that elected them.
The Democratic leadership.
Big old bird. And I'm thinking that the way to wake leadership up and make them more responsive. We picked up a lot of pretty tight seats last time. Shuler in North Carolina, I think, is one. And he's a pretty conservative Democrat that's going to vote with Republicans a lot of the time anyway. I'm thinking we primary him and damage him enough that he doesn't win the next election, because Democrats are going to pick up seats either way.
Or just run a good, strong progressive against him. I mean, the untold story of the election of 2006 was that those Democrats who won with the biggest margin, even in the reddest states, I mean, look at, this was 2004, but look at Brian Schweitzer, the governor of Montana. Those Democrats who won with the largest margins were those who were the most progressive. And those who won with the tightest margins and the most expensive races were those who were conservative Democrats. It goes back to Harry Truman's comment that people really want to vote. If they want to vote for a Democrat, they want to vote for a Democrat. And if they want to vote for a Republican, they want to vote for a Republican. And if they're presented with a Democrat who behaves like a Republican versus a Republican, they'll choose the true Republican every time. And, you know, literally that's what Harry Truman said. And so why not have primary challenges against these weak-kneed Democrats and put up good, strong primary, you know, progressive primary challengers and beat them in the primary and run against the Republicans in the national race and win.
Mike, thanks so much for your call. Tom, if I could change the subject real quick here, I wanted to ask you about something that has gotten little or no attention here in the American press, and that is a White House directive regarding national security and homeland security that was issued on May 9th of this year, just a couple of weeks ago. And can you help us tell us what this is and what you think it means?
Well, this is, first of all, what it is it has to do with the continuation of government. And there's actually a group of bipartisan group that's been working on continuation of government. In fact, I think it's continuationofgovernment.org is the website that has been working on this commission for some time. But there have been presidential directives going back to Dwight Eisenhower's years. I think the first one was in like 53 or 54 or something like that. The early Cold War days that had to do with what would happen if the most commonly cited scenario was what would happen if the Russians dropped a nuke on Washington, D.C. and took out Congress. And there has to be some provision for government to continue beyond just what the Constitution provides for of, you know, who replaces the president if he dies or who replaces the president and vice president if both of them die. And so there have been these continuity of government plans in place for a long, long time. And every president edits them and updates them. And so that in and of itself is, you know, arguably not a big deal. What's apparently unique about this one, and I have been trying to track down somebody who's done some good scholarship on this, and we're going to have Michael Ratner on our national show next week, the founder of the Center for Constitutional Rights, ccr-ny.org is their website. He's the guy who is collaboratively with the government of Germany is suing Don Rumsfeld for war crimes to find out the details of it. But it appears that this is the first time that a president has inserted into one of these directives that in the event of, you know, a disaster, first of all, he's redefined disaster. It could be anything, anywhere that disrupts the operations of the United States in a significant way, even economically. So it could be like the Great Depression would be considered a disaster under this. Or another Hurricane Katrina would be considered a disaster under this. And so at that point, then the president invokes this power. And for the first time ever, also, as far as I can tell, this one says that the legislative branch and the judicial branch will continue to operate. Now, keep in mind, we're talking about disasters that don't come anywhere close to Washington, D.C. The Congress is still intact. The courts are still intact. That the legislative and judicial branches of government will still continue to exist and operate, but they will do so under the supervision of the president, which is a fancy way of saying George Bush makes himself emperor. And what I find so interesting about this is that while it has been mentioned, it was first mentioned on the Daily Kos a week or so ago, a liberal blog, probably the most prominent person speaking out about it right now is Jerome Corsi, the guy who started the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth and, notorious right-winger and has now written a book about how we should be bombing Iran, we should start a war with Iran. And he's flipped out about this. He's doing talk shows and stuff saying, you know, this thing, this is the president trying to grab power he has no right to have, and this is wrong. And I have to agree with Jerome. So this is one of those areas where I don't think this is conservative or liberal. I think this is this has to do with American values, constitutional values.
We're talking with Tom Hartman, nationally syndicated radio host of the Tom Hartman Program, heard here in Charlottesville on the new progressive WVAX 1450 AM. And the phone lines are open at 977-1070. Susan, thanks for your patience calling in from Free Union. You're on with Tom Hartman. Go right ahead.
Well, Tom, I take two issues with statements you said, and I've been in a car and I might have misheard it. One, that Republicans never have voter fraud. Or Democrats have never been accused of voter fraud?
No, I said Democrats have never been accused of caging.
Caging.
No, I could give you examples of Democratic voting fraud. You know, Philadelphia, Chicago, sure,
yes.
Absolutely. Vote fraud is as old as the nation is. But, you know, widespread, systematic voter fraud coming from the National Democratic Party, no, there's never been an accusation. At least there's never been a...
Well, in the Senate a couple of years ago, they passed a bipartisan bill aimed at voter fraud, whereas Republicans were aiming at the Democratic Party and the Democrats were aiming at the Republican Party. So, I mean, you had dead people signing up in St. Louis County to vote. I personally witnessed it in Milwaukee in a U.S. Senate race where people were shipped in from Chicago to vote that obviously weren't Wisconsin residents.
Yeah,
I think it goes on both sides.
If you witness that, you should tell a U.S. attorney, because Alberto Gonzalez is desperate for his federal prosecutors to find even one such case. They've found 36 of them so far nationwide in the last 6 years, and they have spent hundreds of millions of dollars looking for them. So if you have personal knowledge of it, I would suggest that you immediately call the FBI. They want to know about that.
Susan, thanks so much for the call. Tom, we've got a couple of minutes left, and I did want to ask you, you are the author of nearly a couple of dozen different books, one of which is titled What Would Jefferson Do? And here in Charlottesville, of course, home of Thomas Jefferson, James Monroe and James Madison lived right up the street. What would Jefferson do today?
Well, it's a good question, because if you look at different times in his life, his positions might have been somewhat different. That's one of the things that kind of allows people all over the political spectrum to claim Jefferson as their own. First of all, I think he would be horrified by the influence of money in government. Jefferson was consistent throughout most of his life in saying things like, you know, I don't look to the rich for the salvation of this nation, I trust the people. I mean, it was one of his big debates with John Adams, who referred to the average working person as the rabble. And Adams thought that, you know, as few people as possible should vote. And Jefferson thought as many people as possible should vote. He believed in small-d democracy, the idea that the people will screw things up. You know, uneducated, non-professional legislators, whatever, they'll make mistakes. But they will also, because they will suffer the results, the consequence of those mistakes, they will also fix the mistakes quickly. And so he always, you know, wanted more involvement rather than less, and was an advocate of that. And what we're seeing with this enormous aggregation of power and wealth is a result in large part of a series of Supreme Court decisions starting in 1886 with the Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, leading up to Buckley versus Viejo and First National Bank of Boston versus Bilotti in the 1970s and 80s, that have said that basically free speech, political free speech is sacrosanct, you know, can't be touched, which is a good thing, and that in our society, money equals speech, which I think is a bad thing, and therefore you can't put limitations on how much money is spent, you know, in politics. We have Washington, D.C., awash in money, and I think that's why on both the Democratic and Republican sides, on both sides. And let me just say, I'm not speaking as a Democrat. I'm a registered independent and have been my entire life. That on both sides, you find enormous. I don't want to use, you know, inflammatory words like corruption. Let's call it allegiance to moneyed interests rather than to the will and interests of we the people. And I know that would horrify Thomas Jefferson.
Tom Hartman, award-winning and best-selling author. He's host of the nationally syndicated Tom Hartman radio program. You can listen to it Monday through Friday right here in Central Virginia from noon to 3 o'clock on the new progressive WVAX 1450 AM. Tom, it's been great to have you on the program, and I would hope that you would join me again soon.
Thank you, Coy. Anytime. I'd be honored. I'm pleased to be on your program and very pleased to be on your radio station as well. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. The show can be heard every Monday through Friday from 4 to 6 o'clock on News Radio 1070 WINA. This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at SevillePodcast.com. If you enjoyed the show, why not check out our site for hours and hours of archives of Coy's show? You'll also find other radio programs, arts features, public affairs coverage, and more.